Irreverent, entertaining, cool talk radio.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. We're in studio. I'm Keith Razor with Alan Lee, the one and only, who doesn't say when I introduce him.
I'm here.
Oh, hey, Alan.
I swear to God, I'm here. I was just zoning out. I'm just staring at the tape a moment. You know, I got to get myself together.
You're zoning out because we have an amazing guest.
We do indeed. And, I just met him.
Yeah.
I'm just helping Alan with his buckles here to get everything back. You know, get him out of that jacket. You know.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
We have the great Paul Williams here.
Yes, indeed.
Now, Paul, before we start, I just got to tell you this story. So we were about to start. Alan's like, we're like, how should we start the show? Alan's like, we should play one of Paul's songs. I was like, no, I can't get sued. He's like, no, we're interviewing him. He's not going to sue us.
Yeah, well, no. The fact is, when one of my songs is played, not only do I not sue you, but I do a Snoopy Happy Dance, because when my songs are played on the air, then I am compensated for
that's
it.
Right. You know?
So, yeah. Yes. That's what part of what ASCAP does.
Yeah. There you go.
A relationship there that there I'm very grateful for. But you know what? No, that's I'm not here. I saw your act when you were working with Craig, and I loved it. And when you asked if I'd come and do this, I was happy to do it, because it was enjoyable to sit in the audience. I thought, if we sit down in the cross room with a couple microphones and somebody that needs to be taken out of the straitjacket, it's going to be a terrific time, I'm yours. It's your 45 minutes, and I'm right. I'm planning to enjoy myself.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I remember meeting you, and I'm going to be honest. I know you from Goliath, which is one of my favorite shows.
Thank you. And, Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah. Yep. And I remember I was sewing my shirts, and I saw you outside. I was like, you're from Goliath.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I'm
it's
sure.
It's almost like the universe is playing a joke on us. Isn't it? It's like that I'm on a show called Goliath at five foot two,
Yeah.
Never too late for a short joke or too early, defensive humor.
Yeah. But then, I followed you on Twitter. And I was like, oh, Mom, the guy from Goliath was at my show today. And she's like, no way. And then I was like, yeah. And then, we were watching an episode. I was like, that's him. She's like, that's Paul Williams. I was like, yeah, she knows you from,
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, that was just shocking.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to enlighten you and everything, and to be here and all. And the fact that Goliath was enough for you to want me here is really great and everything. So just because not allowed to talk about anything else. No, it's my, I'm nothing but grateful. I've had an amazing life and an amazing, actually a couple lives and a couple of careers, because I pissed away the first one. I got drunk and filled my nose full of cocaine for a decade.
Yeah.
When you misplace a decade, you are definitely an alcoholic. So, and 29 years ago, my life, instead of coming to, I woke up and it's been an amazing life. So,
yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about. And anytime you put a microphone in front of me, I have a tendency to get on my little soapbox about how blessed a recovered life is, and these days also to take advantage of the chance to talk about music creators' rights, and that's really important to me as well. So those are the two biggies for me, the things that I'm most grateful for, and so I should be, if I stick to those things, I'll be really boring, and that's how I turn my life around. I'm the Pali Lama, come touch the hem,
Now, we were talking in the elevator that you did Carson 48 times. Was that the record of Carson?
No. I think somebody did it 200 times. I'm trying to
200 times?
200, and if you don't remember the name of the guy who did it 200 times, you're either really old or just so egomaniacal you don't pay attention. But no, it was, I think that there are a couple comedians who were on there all the time.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which ones. But I will, as soon as we're off the air, I'll remember it. That's the way it is.
And then we'll just have to invite you back and be like, we got to answer those questions.
Yeah, it's, Yeah, it was at the time there were like three channels, you know, and you had basically ABC, NBC, and CBS were the three networks. Those are the three possibilities for late night entertainment. You had Letterman, you had Carson, and afternoons you had Mike Douglas. Mm-hmm. There were a few things where you could get to a huge audience. Mm-hmm. Nothing bigger at the time than Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
And I think that what was, first of all, I always felt like home there. I had two great friends that were there on the show. One was Pat McCormick, and the other one was Ed McMahon. And both known to be, to enjoy, the variety of substances to keep them smiling. So we'd do the show, but off the show, Pat McCormick and I did a bunch of things together, including the art film Smokey and the Bandit. He played Big Enos, and I played Little Enos. But we did a batch of things for the Fall Guy with Lee Majors and all. We had a great time together, and I was great friends with Ed McMahon. I loved Ed McMahon. Ed McMahon was just a big teddy bear, a big slobbery, wonderful teddy bear. And by having that relationship with Ed McMahon, there were many times when after the show, he'd go to dinner with somebody that I would go, "That wow, you're going out, you're going to have dinner with Orson Welles. Oh, well, how can I say? Okay, Paul, you want to come along?" And I would tag along.
Be like, "Oh, yeah, sure, definitely."
Nice.
The great thing about what we do is you don't have to give up your fan card. I don't have to stop being a fan, and I can't. I don't have to, so I don't want to. If I'm sitting in a room and Quincy Jones walks in the room, and I've known him since the 60s, I still go, "Wow, it's Quincy Jones. There's Q. Wow."
That actually brings me a lot of comfort that you said that, because I've been doing stand-up comedy for a long time, and I've worked with some of my heroes, but yet I'm still overly obsessed with their work. What I mean? I'm still a fan.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Why should you give up something you really love to do what you really love, which is what they also do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I was working with Craig, it's hard for me to not ask him comedy questions, because it's nice to know that I could still be a fan.
And Craig, Craig will tell you everything, unless he thinks, "Oh, wait a minute, this is not going to work at all, because his career is going to go sailing by me if I tell him that one thing." He must never know that. No, Craig's a really good guy, I babble on after I make my point sometimes, but the point is really that's one of the best things about what we get to do for those people for a living, is you can wind up with the game shows back in the 70s were always a thrill. You do something like Hollywood Squares,
right,
and you show up and you have no idea who's going to be in the other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 squares, whatever, you had to count them. But it was amazing. You'd walk in there and there's Vincent Price, for God's sakes. Oh, wow. You go, "Jesus, there's Vincent Price," And you do five shows. You do three shows. You break for lunch. Everybody has a couple drinks. So the Thursday and Friday shows were always very loose. And it was a great place to forge some lasting friendships, too. Bill Bixby and I were great friends and ran into each other, I think, the first time walking the halls of NBC while he was doing, one of the game shows and I was doing another one. But winding up on in squares together or something was the beginning of a really, a long life-lasting, as far as he lived, friendship,
I have a question. How much money did you win on the game shows?
I never, not a penny, not a penny. I won money for other people, I think, on some of the charitable ones, but yeah, exactly. It's the reason that I don't, I all the time that I played Vegas, I never really gambled. I thought, wait a minute, $300 in a slot machine, that's perfectly good drug money. I was, it was just, that's who I was at the time.
Are you still playing, going around, or
very seldom? Once in a while, but I've got an adult, responsible job with ASCAP. For the last 11 years, ASCAP is the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. We're a performing rights organization. We license the music from everybody, from back to the days of Gershwin and Cole Porter to Beyonce, you know, and Billie Eilish, and just you know, the hottest, and ASCAP's 105 now.
Wow.
Years old. It's 700,000 members, and basically what we do is anywhere you see music played, from restaurants and bars and grills and the like to anything on the internet, you know, radio, television, it's all, we license all that music and collect it and send it immediately to our members. We're a membership organization. We're like this country. We, you know, of, by, and for the songwriters and the and the publishers. So the reason I wrote the title song, for example, Charlie Fox and I wrote the title song to The Love Boat. And I remember saying to Charlie, a song about a cruise ship. Why, this will probably not last a month. And he said, well, let's see.
Yeah.
You know, and and it was around 11 years, you know. So my kids, you know, schooling was paid for, and the gas in the car and the food on the table, all that was part of the royalties from that show. And that's what we do. And, and it's, that's why I'm really grateful and passionate for this gig for the last 11 years as president, because we can make a difference in music creators' lives. There was a big bill that was passed called the Music Modernization Act, and it's going to help, going to make a difference in how musicians, or rather how songwriters and all are compensated in the streaming world, you know. So nobody listens to music like they used to. It's all streaming these days.
That's true.
Witness where we are right now.
It's kind of like comedy. Everyone, like a lot of people, don't go out to comedy. They just listen on the stream.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but it's nice that musicians have more of a protection, because I don't think comedians have a protection guild like that.
I don't think there's a licensing for jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. If, you know, how much comedy would disappear if it be, you know, if there was liability in stealing a joke? I'll just change the setting from a graveyard to a supermarket, and, you know, hey woman, is that dog happy to see you, or is that a, but you know, the fact is, with the internet came a lot of problems like that, and as brilliant and wonderful as it is as a tool to learn and celebrate and promote. The fact is that everything from newspapers to you name it is feeling the crunch of moving to a platform that just doesn't really get as close to true value as it needs to. It's a changing world. It's a changing world. But people seem to, you know, people love music, and in a time in Washington, D.C. when you can't, you know, get anybody, you know, the two sides of the aisle to agree on which direction the sun comes up, east or west, they actually unanimously supported the Music Modernization Act, and for which we are beyond grateful that it was unanimous in the House and Senate, and that's fantastic.
Now, you're the president of this. Is it something that you run for, or did you just get elected, or how did you get that job?
There was the heavens parted first. The heavens parted, you know, and a large figure burned down and said, "Don't let him anywhere near the boardroom until he gets sober." And that's kind of that was the first thing. That voice was actually a brilliant lyricist named Hal David, who was a great friend and a mentor. And I ran for the board in the 80s and a couple times, and I was not. It was not elected, and so when Hal Davis said, "You need to run again," I said, "You know, I ran twice in the 80s. I wasn't elected." Yeah. He said, "And it's a safer world because of it. But now is your time. You should." So 2001, I was voted onto the board, and then you know the membership votes on who's going to sit on the board, and then the board elects the officers. In 2009, I was elected president and chairman.
Oh, that's awesome.
Nice.
I'm sure everyone in music is glad that you got elected. I mean, who were you running against?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're running against the other members of the board and all. And the fact is that...
I was making a bad joke.
Yeah, exactly. Who was I running against? Well, there are no cartoon characters. Everybody sitting on the board is esteemed and established, and you know they're guys that run cute little companies like Warner, you know, Warner Music and Universal Music and songwriters like Jimmy Webb, and,
yeah,
you know, Marcus Miller, just you know, great, amazing. Again, we go back to that thing about your fan card.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
That's just so, like, your career, you have just got to be, because I know you from your acting, but, like, from your music, like, you could pull both. Like, that's just got to be, like, very amazing and, like, very hard, too. You know what I mean?
Well, the music, is, you know, came as a gift, and, yeah. and it was the gift of no. Because I started out, all I wanted to do was act. All I wanted to do was be somebody other than me. I think, you know, a good therapist would say. A bad therapist would say it as well, but probably charge more. So. I started out, I did a couple movies. I did a movie called The Loved One, which was about the funeral business. Very odd, weird picture. I played a 14-year-old or 13-year-old in it, and I was like 22, you know. So I look like a kid until, and it's an old joke, but I look like a kid until you put me next to a real kid. Then I look like a kid with a hangover, and it was just, which was usually, of course, the case. And then, but I did a movie called, after that, 2 years later, did a movie called The Chase with Marlon Brando and Robert Redford, Jane Fonda.
Huge, Jane Fonda.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that film.
Yeah, it was a big, big, big movie. Oh, and there were these four teenagers in it. I was one of them. And, but you know, by the time the picture came out, I think I've got two lines in it. He's going to need a better lawyer, and your daddy is one of them, I remember. It's like, my voice was like, he's going to need a better lawyer, and your daddy. And it was, you just don't build a solid career with that kind of a sound coming out of you. And, so the acting career just, you know, I thought the phone was going to ring off the hook. The phone did not ring, and then they took the phone out, and then I was living with my mom, and she had a job, and I was staying up all night writing, trying to write songs. Because on the set of the Chase, I picked up a little guitar that belonged to my roommate, my dressing room roommate, a kid named Mark Seaton. He had a great guitar, and I picked it up. He said, "Don't touch that. It's a Martin." I went, "Okay." You know, I didn't know you gave them names. He said, "No, that's that's not the guitar. That's the brand. Never mind." You know. So, but I was sitting out in front of the little trailer we were in. I went and I bought a little cheap guitar.
Yeah.
And I was sitting out there, and we were shooting a scene where Robert Redford, who was a character named Bubba, was hiding in a junkyard that we had just set fire to as kids. And just for my own amusement, I'm sitting there learning the chords. I didn't even know they had names. C, F, G. It was just, wow, look what I invented. It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, that's a D, Paul. Oh, okay. All righty. What do I do to get an A with something like that? There's another, I gotcha now. So, but I was sitting on the thing, and on the step of the trailer, and I just went, "Bubba, Bubba, Bubba, come out wherever you are. Oh, we're going to come in and get you. Yes, we're going to come in." And Robert Duvall was walking by, and he went, "Wow, what's that?" And I went, "It's a guitar. I just bought it and everything. It's not a Martin, but it's whatever." He said, no, what you were playing. And I said, "I just made it up." And he said, "Come with me." And I thought, oh, God, I'm in trouble. You're not allowed to sing on a movie set. What did I do wrong? You know? Mm-hmm. And that's not a joke. I was actually thinking I had done something that was, you know, I didn't know the rules to a movie set, and maybe I'd ruined a shot or something. But he walked me over to Arthur Penn, the director. He said, "Show him." I said, "It's a guitar I just bought." He said, "Not the guitar. Show him the, you know, the song." And I said, "It's not a song. I just made this up." Blah, 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 blah. And Arthur Penn said, "Stand over by the fence." And then he called out to the tech guy. He said, "Light him up behind him." So they lit up all the, you know, the fire behind me. And they shot it there, and then they put us up on the hot rod that we had all been riding around in the film, and did it again, and he put it in the movie. So it's like sometimes the universe will speak to you.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are billboards, you know, you kind of need to pay attention to, I guess. But that was a huge billboard that, you know, look at this. That was the first little thing you ever wrote on a guitar, and it wound up in what was supposed to be a blockbuster movie. And that's, if it's that huge an accident, you kind of go, whoa, maybe I should try songwriting.
Yeah.
And just to make sure that I did, they took away all the acting jobs for years and years to come.
But no, you're totally right. The universe does act in strange ways, because that's how I met you. Yeah. And then that's how, you know, so yeah, I believe that 100%.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. Alan's looking at his questions.
No, no. This was shaking and buzzing, and I said, I'm going to be in trouble. Like, Paul, I'm going to play something. And I'll say, get the fuck, what's that buzz in the Martin?
Alan has a form of Asperger's too, but he also has ADHD.
Then we can talk. I've never been safer. Exactly. You know,
they've hyphenated it. Every week they add something to my mental problems.
It's gonna be
hyphenated.
But you know, it's interesting because you know the sometimes you know while definitions and names for things are helpful for us to understand kind of the collective thought of this is what Asperger's is, or this is what you know what autism is, or this is what there is this variety of human elements that is brought to every one of our lives.
Yeah.
And while the condition is there, you know, you are a short drunk, and I will always be a short, you know, recovering drunk. But the fact is, once you get to know me, there's a lot of information about how that happened, how I drank myself into that, what I've done with my life since and all. And if nothing else beyond just the enjoyment of having this conversation, it's a chance to to step up to the plate and say I love that you use that quote unquote definition on stage as part of your humor.
Yeah.
And I use my height my entire career, and I look at somebody really evolved and brilliant and just a great actor like Danny DeVito, I never once heard Danny DeVito make a short joke. Yeah. He never had to, he just, and for some reason I did. I mean, I used it as a tool. I go on stage and if I could make the audience laugh, talking about, when I was 13, I hit my head running under a table and whatever, the audience would laugh and I would relax.
Yeah.
And they would relax. And so it became a useful tool. But I also see it as really defensive,
Yeah.
Not offensive. At a certain point, it becomes offensive. You're having an intelligent conversation with somebody, and you throw in a short joke, and they roll their eyes and go, "Come on,
yeah,
let's talk. You don't need to do that shit."
When you were doing those jokes, you made audiences laugh? Did you ever feel maybe I should Did you ever wanted to try to do stand up? Like, was that one of those things you wanted to try?
Yeah, I was watching you. I was telling Keith, I said,
because you're very funny.
God, I would rush home to see him on Carson because it was like seeing a stand-up comic. I said, my God, songwriter, actor, and now he's going to do this. I found you that funny, and I'm not the only one.
That's a great compliment.
Thank you.
You know, I don't know that I have the courage. I lived in the Hollywood Hills right up above the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in and out of there once in a while. It's a tough way to make a living. It's a tough way. One of my dearest friends was Freddie Prinze.
Oh.
And Freddie was just, and little Freddie, his son Freddie Prinze is like family, who I never see, and that's just outrageous. But we tweet back and forth, and we text. But Freddie was like, Freddie was cast in Chico and the Man, excuse me, and there was this lovable, cuddly character that he was playing that would fill his audiences. We travel and work together a bunch, and the little old ladies and their kids would come in expecting to see Chico.
Yeah,
and Freddie was not Chico.
Yeah.
Freddie was closer to Lenny Bruce.
Oh.
And he kicked the edges out and all. And that combined with the fact that you do a joke on television once, he said, I got to come up with something else the next time. That's just, I can't imagine feeding that machine week after week after week. And you look at guys like Carlin, how do they do it? How do you do it? It's but being funny, I think, is born out of heartache or mm-hmm. or terror,
right.
or mm-hmm. You know, it's or feeling different.
Yeah,
you know, and it's when we embrace the difference and present our authentic self, either as humor or as music, whatever, to an audience, is when I think you hit a home run. I'll give you a classic example, whether you want it or not.
Oh, I definitely want it.
I had a little brother. He was 6'2" as an adult. And his name was Mentor Williams. My little brother was one of those kids that, like, when I was a kid, they would have me sing for the neighbors, and I was like 9 or 10 or 11, whatever. And he was like 4 or 5. He'd stand behind the curtain or the kitchen door and watch me singing. And then you'd hear, after I got a little applause from the neighbors, you'd hear, "Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose." And it would be my son, my brother Mentor. Okay. And he'd stick his head out and he'd go, "I can sing too." And then he'd walk off like he was going to go kick somebody's ass. You know? Well, cut to him in his early 20s, and he wanted to write songs. And I was having a really pretty good career at that point in the early 70s. And he came out to Hollywood, and I got him a 6-month contract at A&M Records, where I was as a staff writer.
Oh, that's awesome.
And for 6 months he tried to write hits.
Yeah.
I mean, he was listening to what was happening, what was current. He was writing kind of a rockabilly style that wasn't really happening, and he just, like, nothing happened. Nobody listened to the demo through the bridge.
Right.
So the gig was over. So it was a Saturday. He had to clean his office out on the next Monday. So he goes into A&M Records, is the old Charlie Chaplin Studios. It's an old movie lot. So he's got a little office on upstairs, a couple doors down from where mine was. And he goes there on a Saturday, and it's pouring rain. And there's nobody there but him and the guard and whoever's in the recording studio, because there was a recording studio there. And he's so depressed. He's just like, "Fuck, what do I have to do?" You know. And he's looking around. He has to clean out his office. The dream is behind him, evidently. He's totally confused. And he picks up a pencil and a yellow pad, and he writes, "Day after day, I'm more confused. It's raining outside," so he writes, "yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know, that's a game I hate to lose." He's going to lose this gig.
Sure.
"I'm counting on you to carry me through." And it came out of him all at once. "Give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away."
Wow.
He wrote something that is going to be, people will be snapping their fingers to and dancing to and learning from, I think, forever.
Yeah.
As long as there's music played.
And it came right out of him?
And it came out of the center of his chest. And I think that when we do things where the headwaters of what we do, especially when it's filtered through kindness and honesty,
mm-hmm.
we are capable of doing things that will change not only our lives, but other people's.
100% agree, 100%. And the question I had for you was, is that how, because obviously that's how your brother, you know, got his juices flowing. How do your juices get flowing?
If I listen to me, I have a tough time listening to music that I love. I mean, my favorite band ever was a group called Delaney and Bonnie and Friends.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever heard of them, or there's a good chance you haven't.
Yeah, for the sake of this interview.
At this point, what you need to do at some point, check out their first album. It's called Accept No Substitutes. And, I mean, this band was so different from what I was basically known for writing. I wrote a lot of what I call codependent anthems. You know, I write, ouch mommy songs, yeah. Pick me up and love me, I'm nothing without you, come back, you know. But this was just like great gospel rock. And I'd sit and listen to them, and all I wanted to do was run out of the troubadour,
right?
Because I'm just so inspired by what I hear. I mean, listening to the Beatles was like, I got more energy for writing out of the first cut on Rubber Soul than I did on 21 years of life experience. Just that, oh my God, how do you do something that good? You know, and if you've just finished an album and you hear here's something that the Beatles did, or Wings with Paul McCartney, or whatever. You just go, shit, start over, start over, you know. But the original Delaney and Bonnie and Friends also had Leon Russell on keyboard. It had Carl Riddle on bass. It, you know, name some of these names you won't know, but Leon Russell is one of my favorites ever for voice, musician, songwriter.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, I just heard it?
You know, yeah, so what inspires me? People do.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I was sitting up all night with my mom was going to work, I'd brought her out to take care of her, and she wound up taking care of me. She'd get up in the morning, and I'd be playing in my pajamas, playing my little guitar, trying to write songs. And she would lean over and she'd go, "Don't worry, my son. God has a plan." And then she'd walk away and she'd hear her muttering things like, "Son of a bitch. Said, what's going to happen? He's so little like that." And so I'd say to her, you know, I'd say, "Mom, what's going on?" And she went, which for her was a word, "You know, you wouldn't understand. I'm just feeling old."
Yeah.
So I sit down when I'm writing with a guy named Roger Nichols, and we're writing songs and doing pretty good. We had a big hit with the Carpenters. We've only just begun. The next thing we wrote for them, or soon after anyway, he plays me this gorgeous melody, and I go, "What am I going to write about?" Ba-da-dee-da-dee, ba-da-da-da, da-dee-da-da. So that's how we'd write. He'd finish the melody. I'd add the words. So I did it, and I remembered my mom talking to myself and feeling old, so... The life experience is what generally comes out. You know, as much as I try to be clever, as much as I try to be, "Oh, this is one that will really impress them. Oh, Paulie, you are moving into new heights here." That's one that I write. If it impresses me with how clever it is, it'll probably sit in a drawer until even I forget about it.
Yeah.
But if I write about what I'm feeling, like, you know, "Wow, I'm scared and lonely," you know, so I sit down with a guy named Kenny Asher, and we write, "Loneliness takes the romance out of falling stars, fills the wishing wells and fills the bars, run and hide the scars of loneliness." You go, "Wow, it's not bad." No, and more importantly, it's honest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge tip for a songwriter.
Is that like, how you like do the lyrics in your mind when you listen to the melody? The lyrics just come to you, and do you like just keep writing different stuff? Because when I write jokes, I've always used to write poetry because, you know, I mm-hmm. thought they could be good songs, but I realized they'd suck, you know, if I like sang it because I'm tone deaf. So then, like, I change it into jokes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, that's how my mind worked.
I think one of the things that is true about my songwriting is that there is no one way I do it, you know, and it changes with the person I'm writing with. Yeah. The way Roger wrote is he'd write a finished melody and give it to me, and we wrote together for years. There's a guy named Kenny Asher that I wrote a lot of songs for. Kenny and I wrote the songs for the Muppet movie, you know, Rainbow Connection and Moving Right Along and all those songs. And the way that we write is he would like, the first song we ever wrote was a song called "You and Me Against the World." And we'd gone to England. He was my piano player. We'd never written, never talked about writing even. But we had all of us. There was something wrong with the permits for my guys to play, and so nobody could play over there. I had to use English musicians, and I'm just hanging with Kenny Asher. We're talking about the old songs, and we started talking about how much we both loved Harry Nilsson.
Yeah.
And I told Kenny, I said, you know, when I met Harry, he played me all the songs of his favorite writer ever, which was Randy Newman. He loved Randy Newman. So just out of the blue, Kenny and I write, "Do you love me, babe? Do you love me not? Let's decide in the morning, not now. Whoa, you don't like Schumann or Randy Newman. Nilsson ain't your cup of tea. You think Van Heusen is a shirt worth choosing, but you're still undecided about me. Whoa, whoa, do you love me?" Just a funny little song. And Kenny Asher looked at me afterwards. He said, "You know, if you started an album with that, it'd be cool to do something like..." And he played, "Bum, bum, 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 bum. Dee-da, dee-da, bum, 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 bum." And looked at me like I was supposed to know what I was supposed to sing then. So I did. I sang, "You and Me Against the World. Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world." He played another chord. And that's how we wrote. Wow. I mean, we went back and forth with both of us working on music and lyrics and up through all the Muppet stuff. Most of the songs in The Star Is Born I wrote with Kenny.
Yeah.
Woman in the Moon, Watch Closely Now, With One More Look at You, songs you probably, you know, may probably don't know.
Yeah, but you know, we should explain to the folks that you wrote for the original Star Is Born.
Exactly. But I love, see, the nice part is that I'm also a huge fan of the second one.
Oh, are you?
And the fact when we wrote ours, we were writing a new version of a movie that I had loved with Judy Garland and James Mason. And James Mason had a great little thing in his version where he would say to Judy Garland as she was walking off, he'd go, "Hold on a second." And she'd turn around and say, "Oh, yes." And he'd go, I just want to take another look at you." So Kenny and I wrote, "With One More Look at You, I Could Learn to Tame the Clouds," but blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it just, the thing is, I think life is a lot easier when you don't claim stuff and try to put it in a closet and say, "This is mine. It's my idea to do Star Is Born. What are you people doing? Get over here. Stand up against the wall. Keep your hands in plain sight. You, what's your name? Scooby? Bradley, what? Get the, you're not even a, wait a minute. And how is it you're sitting out there in the parking lot, and yet you, because of two lines she sings to you later on, you know the entire song. You know, it's just, you know, obviously your drugs were better than mine. You know? I could go there, or I could just let it go. You just have to. Acceptance is huge in recovery,
yeah,
and it's huge in life.
In life,
yeah.
Wow.
You know what? One of the best things about podcasts is, you know, that's recorded. You could re-listen to, and I like think you should do this, you should re-listen to this episode, and you should try stand-up comedy because you've told like 7 great jokes. You know? So I think that would be awesome.
That's really kind. Yeah. Then they'd expect me to come in and do that again. but you know, but life is funny.
Yeah.
Life is funny, okay, no, I'm not going to go there. I was thinking about something that was bathroom humor with Pat and I and a joke that he told, and then I created something, and I went, and I have now made the wise decision for once in my life, self-edit at the last minute when you need it.
I gotta learn that, because like with my no filter, I say stuff, and sometimes like I don't think what I say, you know what I mean? So like, yeah. I'm like, yeah. Like that's why like I try not to stay too much on Twitter, because I think like if you're going back and forth with all these trolls, people, you know.
Oh, yeah. Twitter's frightening.
Like, it's interesting. I haven't had a lot of problems there. I've stated a couple of things about some of my opinions around somebody said, I found a T-shirt that said "Rainy days and automatic weapons always get me down," and I was like, "I just have, you know, I had to have that, you know." So, I posted it on instead of "Rainy days and Mondays," "Rainy days and automatic weapons," and I posted it, and somebody wrote and said, "You know, dummy, you got to learn about, you know, automatic weapons were made illegal many years ago. You gotta know what you're talking about before you you live, fool, but whatever." And I started to write back, "Yeah, but you can buy an auto sear on the internet and turn a semi-automatic." And I went, "Well, no, don't do that. Don't do that. You know?
Oh my God, that's funny.
Because, you know,
funny.
And you have to have been a crazy person with a lot of guns,
sure,
at some point in your life to know what an auto sear is, you know? So,
Speaking of guns, Alan likes hunting and stuff.
I do have a gun fetish. And the funny thing about it is there were no guns. I came from an immigrant family, and my mother's Cuban,
yeah,
from Havana,
yeah,
and my dad's from Hong Kong, and there were no guns. And as a kid, I had to have all the cap guns. I watched every Western on earth.
Yeah.
And I mean, you put a Western on, I said, fuck football, baseball, Little League, fuck all that. Yeah, this is a Western on, right?
Exactly.
And so not until I came to California, I bought my first pistol right around the corner in North Hollywood at the Surplus, Western Surplus, I remember that store.
Sure.
And I said, "That looks so good.
I got to leave now." It was really...
No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to... Oh, my God. I'm scared. That was 300 people.
No, go ahead.
You know.
I get it, though.
Yeah.
It
was a toy. It was a toy for me. I wasn't defending myself or a family to defend. I thought, God, I can't be from cap gun to this. You know, my father was just... you know, because you know, and but it, it was my it was my Western fetish. I go to the Gene Autry Western Heritage Museum all the time to stand there and look around.
Yeah, you know, I loved I loved the Singing Cowboys. You know, the Rex Allen, you know, and the like.
Roy, but throw Roy in there.
Yeah, but I mean, if, great Western films too, like you know, like Big Country and.
John Ford stuff.
All the John Ford stuff.
Have you ever done a Western?
Well, let me think. There's a lot of Maybeville in my life. I have to give it a moment here to rerun, you know. Not really. Not a... Yeah, wait, I have to. I did a TV movie called Wild Wild West Revisited.
Oh, my God. That's not a Western. I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's Wild Wild West Revisited.
Oh, that's a classic.
And, yeah, and I played Miguelito Lovelace Jr.
That's
yeah.
right. Oh, my God. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
For heaven's sakes, I should have brought that up.
Michael Dunn was the actor that played
Miguelito. That's
right. And
Michael Dunn.
People said, you know, mm-hmm. you know, so you're going to play Michael Dunn's son. How do you feel about that? I said, I'm scared to death, you know. And they said, why? I said, because the level of acting that he was capable of was just phenomenal. I mean, he was brilliant.
Amazing.
But yeah, and you know, and I, not to get into the whole gun thing and everything, yeah. but I think that something has to be done about background,
sure.
and blah blah, you know, this and blah blah that and all.
Sure.
But everything is so divisive and so crazy, and I think that first of all, yeah, of course, there are mental health issues. Absolutely.
Sure,
yeah.
sure absolutely.
But the rest of the world has mental health issues, and a lot of the things that we're dealing with over here, and they just don't have the amount of mass murder that we've experienced. So I think we have to... It's a classic example of something where, you know, there were two senators that couldn't agree on anything. They were at the opposite sides of the coin on almost all issues. A deep Republican named Orrin Hatch,
sure.
and Ted Kennedy.
Oh.
You know,
yeah.
the Libs live.
Yeah,
and they did meaningful work together. They did the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
They did
mm-hmm.
stuff around AIDS mm-hmm. and children, mm-hmm. and I think it's an amazing opportunity at this point mm-hmm. where the people who have proven that they can talk to each other about certainly music can perhaps now you know do something and the fear-based thinking that if we give this much, which is going to make it a little harder for the wrong guy to get his hands on a gun. There's so many people, their fear-based thinking is that it's gonna, you know, that's gonna go, and then following that is something else and something else and something else. And I live one day at a time,
yeah.
And I certainly don't want to offend anybody with you know where I come down on this mm-hmm. the issue, but something has to be done. Something's got to be done.
So. Yeah. And I'm a gun person,
yeah.
but
yeah,
but you know,
I would take every bullet that I own. And take it. I would be happy to register the bullet.
Oh my!
You know, is it Chris Rock that has the great thing about you know? Was it Chris that said you had to charge like $1,000 for a bullet?
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
You know, charge all that money for the bullets.
That might work though.
Well, yeah. A lot of wealthy people would have guns. Yeah.
But it's you know, and it's a hot button issue, and we're in a time at this. I just hope
yeah.
that people will. Yeah. You know, instead of backing into you know their own corner of thought and digging a deeper trench to peer over the edge of, they'll talk and try to get something done.
Yeah, you know, when you were telling that story about the senators, like my mind was because like I was thinking of a joke. Yeah, so like it's gonna be bad, but you want to hear a bad joke
about
the senators? You kind of wrote it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm just gonna like try all and finish right. it. So, like, there's these two senators, you know, the right on the left. They couldn't agree on anything. You know, Bob Dole and who's another senator?
Ed Kennedy.
They hated each other. Ted Kennedy. They hated each other, you know. They couldn't agree.
Ralph Kennedy also works really good, you know.
Ralph Kennedy. But they did agree on one thing. Viagra's the best. But yeah, but like that's where my mind goes is like someone would say something really interesting. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then I'd be like, I can make that funny. You know what I mean?
And you did.
Yeah.
And
it was
cute.
Exactly.
But I don't think Bob Dole and Kennedy were in the same time period.
but
I think there was a little overlap.
A crossover. There was an overlap.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh. Around. Yeah. They knew each other.
Then I just wrote the funny joke.
It's really funny. But you know what? You pick out two, you know, extreme senators and, from today's current thing that are of a little older and fire away.
Uh-huh. You know, I wanted to ask Paul about, along the recovery line and psychology, I have a friend, he's always talking about trauma and the reactions of your early childhood that you don't know are there, that CPTSD, you know, and then you take something to heal that, which unfortunately could be a drug or a drink. And what's your opinion? A chemical band-aid.
Yeah.
And he had that book, Shame. But anyway, what do you think of the idea of trauma that exists in someone?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's interesting because there was a woman, I believe it was Alice Miller, wrote a book that was big hit called The Drama of the Gifted Child. She wrote another book, and I don't remember the name of it, but it was interesting. She did a study of very famous, very successful, evil and wonderful people. Mm-hmm. We're talking Picasso and Hitler and that world. And she wondered what the examples she chose were all people that had traumatic events in their childhood. And why, through all these traumatic events that they all experienced, why did some of them emerge as Hitler, you know the essence of evil? And why did somebody emerge, you know, as somebody who moved through that mm-hmm. trauma and became creative and did meaningful work and the like a Picasso? Picasso, I think, in his childhood, watched his mother give birth during a horrible earthquake. I'm not sure if she died or not, but I think she may have died during that earthquake. But what she found that was the difference between the two sides is the phrase sympathetic witness. If there's some child who's being beaten in a home, the kind of abuse you imagine, that if there's somebody there that says, you know what, the things that have happened to you, which you are now safe from, mm-hmm. should never have happened to you, and you don't deserve any of that. That's not the way the world is ever supposed to operate, and that's not the way your life is going to operate, and you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So when this terrible thing happened to you, it's an oddity. It's not going to be like that. And come here and let me put my arms around you. Let mm-hmm. me hold you. That sympathetic witness gave a shading of a perspective to the unconscious, you know, something to carry in the depths of whatever mm-hmm. of our souls, you know, that makes a difference in later years. I'm sure at the time, who knows what the child's reaction to it is, but to have somebody there offering pure love makes a difference. I think that what happens with all of us that are, you know, that got sober, one of the things that happens is after you've been sober a little while, you start to look at your life and go, wow. Like my childhood was really, looked like Dickens wrote it, you know. I mean, my dad died when I was 13. In a car wreck, I was this tiny little guy with a slow body clock, shipped off to live with an aunt and uncle in Long Beach, California. They were like basically knife fighting drunks, and it was. I mean, there was a lot of stuff, you know. And I didn't feel any of it at the time. Mm-hmm. I just stayed busy.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that was my band-aid at the time.
Sure.
And then at a certain point in my life, vodka became a band-aid, and then, you know, and I was having this amazing life. You know, why did I just keep diving into the booze mm-hmm. and all? And you know what? I dive into the booze because I'm an alcoholic. I could have had the perfect childhood, and the fact is there's something in the way I process alcohol and something in the way I think. I mean, long before I drank like an alcoholic, I acted like one because I didn't feel so much of that. Mm-hmm. So you're spot on, is what I'm saying. Thank a shorter you. Answer would have been you're right, you know.
Thank
but
you.
But it's an important observation.
Wow, thank you.
Because it also opens up the door to us mm-hmm. forgiving people, you know.
True, true.
Yeah.
Now I have one more question, and because we're running out of time, but this goes back to very the beginning. Goliath.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I've never had more. I've never had. You know, I walked into the office. I'm friends with Billy Bob. We became friends.
Billy Bob's like one of my favorites.
Oh, he's great. Yeah. He's fantastic. And the Boxmasters are fabulous.
Yeah.
He's a really good songwriter. So he said, the producers of the show, there's something going on. They want to talk to you. Go meet with the guys. And so this was after the first season of Goliath, and he had won the Emmy for Best Actor. So I went in to the producer's office. Larry has got a huge Phantom of the Paradise poster on the wall of his office. And I went, this is already my favorite meeting ever, ever. I said, what do you want me to do, read or whatever? And he said, no, I want you to say yes. And they wanted me to play this character, JT, who's, you know, he's a disillusioned attorney that doesn't trust the system. He has all these devices to listen to the cops. He does only pro bono work for gang members in L.A. He speaks a little Spanish. Yeah, si tú quisieras hablar español, you know, con este chingadero, yo soy listo. Anyway, it was a wonderful character, and I did the second season. I did like four, and then we just finished shooting. Well, we just finished like a month or so ago. Finished season three.
Are you in all of them on season three?
No. I think that they're trying to back away slowly. They're not realizing what they've gotten themselves into. No, I think about the same number. I think four of them. I think there's four.
Nice.
And but it's just a great relationship. And what Billy does is, you know, first of all, he's so absolutely in the moment.
Yeah.
And everything is, you know, the first day on the set, his character was supposed to walk in with a case of beer. And he says, how do you feel about that? And I said, I think there's more tension if, you know, you're the drunk that Billy is on Goliath, and I'm sober. Yeah. And he said, I agree, lose it. And so they get rid of the booze. The first thing we were shooting where I was in that little island in the L.A. River and fishing for metal, he yells out at me. I said, hold on a second. I couldn't hear him, and I put my hearing aids in. And the next scene we shot on a dam, he walks up and on camera says, put your hearing aids in. I said, okay. So I put my hearing aids in. I mean, he makes the things that are part of my life part of JT's character. And I think that's true about so much of his character, except for the drinking. He's, you know, he's one of the most generous actors I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
And I've never, ever had an adult acting job that I've enjoyed more. You know, I mean, I did a lot of cartoon acting, Smokey and the Bandit 1-2, and even worse, you know. But this is just a privilege to walk on that set.
Yeah, I have a Billy Bob joke, and I don't know if I told it at the improv, but I think you'll really enjoy it because you're friends with him. But I was with this girl, and we'll end it on this. She was like, let's role play, let's be celebrities. And I was like, I don't really want to be celebrities, you know? She's like, you be Brad Pitt and I'll be Angelina Jolie. And I was like, oh, I'd rather be Billy Bob. Because he has more range, you know? So then I go deeper, and then she's like, say something from one of your movies. And I'm like, oh, let the rabbit go, you know? And she's like, no, you're Brad Pitt. I was like, oh, right. But that's what I'm saying is, like, Billy Bob's acting is just so, like, you go in different ranges, you know? And it's kind of like your songwriting ability too. Yeah, so
thank you.
That's talent. With talent, it makes beautiful art. That's what I'm saying.
You know, it's just it's spectacular, and to be able to do it, to still be writing and writing with some wonderful people at this point in my life, it's just, you know, it's all again. It's all a gift. It's one of I keep going back to that. You know, the other thing is that a lot of the people I'm working with, I know because of something that I did not write off, although there was every reason to write it off as a failure back in 1974, and that's Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah.
You know, Guillermo del Toro, who, you know, I'm writing Pan's Labyrinth for the stage with Guillermo and Gustavo Santaolalla and Jeremy Unger, we're taking this amazing movie, you know, to the stage. It's a long, slow process. And Daft Punk, the same situation. They were... Guillermo, I signed Guillermo's soundtrack album of Phantom of the Paradise when he was in his teens in Mexico City. Came to my show, you know, in his dad's suit, and you know, borrowed the family car or whatever, and came to the show. Daft Punk saw the one of the few places that, that Phantom of the Paradise was a hit was in Paris. Paris and Winnipeg, the two cities it was a hit. And the two guys, you know, Tumon and Guiman, who were are Daft Punk with their masks, their robot masks, and hidden identities, anonymity, which I admire so much. They met they saw it Phantom together like 20 times, you know. Yeah. So there's a big lesson there beyond the fact that I can name drop, you know, a couple of groups that I'm working with, but the fact that, you know. You know, when you write something and the world doesn't respond, you know, you feel like, you know, this is that's going nowhere. You know, the Big Amigo has his own time frame, and life has its own time frame. And something that you were so proud of make bounce up and bite you on the ass, like, well, that was just a joke. I was only joking. Yeah, but you don't joke about those things in 2019. And so we've seen that, and so far that has not emerged in my life. Thank you, Lord. But the other side of it is something that was panned, and you just didn't understand why. A variety, when the Muppet Christmas Carol came out, called the songs pedestrian, and it's one of the most great joys of my life is the mail I get around Christmas around the Muppet movie or the Muppet Christmas Carol and Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas and things I did with Jim Henson that just didn't, you know, I mean, the Muppet movie did really well. Muppet Christmas Carol was like, you know, how did we miss? We didn't.
Yeah.
It just takes time for people to
catch on.
Or to watch it with their families, you know, about 2 days before Christmas. It's a different thing than watching it, you know, in a theater when this is the 18th film you've reviewed in the last 16 days or whatever, so.
Well, Paul, we're out of time, but where can the folks at home follow you on Instagram, Twitter?
At PaulieLama2 is my Instagram account.
All right.
And Twitter is at the letter I, the letter M, Paul Williams. I am Paul Williams. Plus, there's a variety of people that every now and then decide they want to pop up as pretending to be me. So, you know, you follow them for a little while before we catch them. But I love it. And the people that do follow me and are really generous and kind, and that's really important to me. I'm very grateful.
Well, Paul, I'm grateful for you and grateful for this interview, and I'm actually grateful that you responded to my tweet. So thank you so much.
Anytime. Fantastic. Anytime. Yes. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
God bless. Thank you.
Thank you.
Guys, subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcast, and follow Paul Williams, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.